Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. This weekend, protesters in Russia are planning to continue their ongoing rallies, calling for opposition candidates to be allowed to run for office next month. Protesters are also calling for political prisoners to be released. Demonstrations have occurred in Moscow and other cities every weekend since July 14th, when the Moscow Election Commission rejected 17 opposition candidates from running for seats on the municipal council. So far, 2,500 people have been detained. Today's guest, Alexei Kovalev, reports that the state has responded with unprecedented repression. He writes that armies of masked riot police greatly outnumber the protesters. They're viciously beating them with rubber batons. There have been multi-pronged pre-dawn raids on protesters' homes and arrests of opposition leaders. Universities are threatening to expel students spotted at the protests. Igor Zuvgov, a political science student, was arrested and charged with mass rioting, a criminal offense that carries up to 8 years in prison. Alexei Kovalev joins us to discuss media coverage. He is head of investigations at Medusa. That's an independent Russian news outlet. He has been writing about the protests for The Guardian. Hi, Alexei. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us. Alexei, before we dive in and talk about Russia, on our media roundtable, we like to start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out. So what caught your attention this week?
Can I toot my own horn?
Of course.
Okay, so because I had the investigations desk at Medusa, we had an investigative piece that came out last week, and it has to do with the protests that are going on right now. So before this big rally on August 10, anonymous Telegram channel, which is really big in Russia, it's a messenger, but it's kind of a social media as well. So an anonymous Telegram channel, pretending to be connected to the police, released an Excel, a spreadsheet containing personal details of 3,000 people, 3,000 plus people, and kind of threatening these protesters with vaguely threatening them with violence, and that was sort of a retribution for protesters releasing the personal details of riot police attacking people in the streets. So that was kind of a tit for tat measure. But I looked at the file, and turns out that it was full of really random people who happened to be near the protest, or they were detained at the protest and their details were in the file in exactly the way the police recorded them. So it was really a leak from the police. And in addition to that, there were about a dozen hundred people whose details were, I think they were picked up from the cell towers near the protest. So people were walking by, or they were at the protest but not detained. But their details were in the file with their passport numbers and their home addresses. The way they put these details in when they registered the SIM cards, when they applied for a data plan. So we looked into this anonymous Telegram channel, and we found out that it wasn't really the police. It was a PR manager from Moscow who was probably hired to run that, to promote that Telegram channel for whoever that was. And turns out a lot of these Telegram channels run anonymously by people claiming to be from corridors of power or, you know, issuing these anonymous threats against the protesters. They are really just social media projects, and they're doing these things for the highest bidder. So somebody leaked this police file to them, and they just released it. Now these people, with our help, we helped a few hundred of these people identify themselves in this file, in this doxing operation, and they're now suing the police for you know, breaking the privacy law. We'll see how it goes, but it's hopefully a big case. And it all started with this protest that have been going on for several weeks now, and they're, you know, the police are supposed to carry ID badges with them, but while beating people in the streets with batons and attacking them viciously, you know, we have some broken limbs and concussions. They are concealing these badges and they are concealing their faces. So there have been some grassroots operations to identify these police officers and sue them. And that is the kind of retribution you can face when you do that.
No. Well, and since you brought up the great reporting that you all are doing at Medusa, which is an independent journalism outlet in Russia, can you give us a sense, Alexei, of what the media landscape is like in Russia? Because I've been reading about the protests. There's been good reporting from the Washington Post, the New York Times. They have reporters in Moscow. So can you talk about the media landscape there?
Okay, so we have the media landscape is in Moscow and in Russia. It's almost totally dominated by state-owned media, like literally state-owned. These are state enterprises with dozens of hundreds of employees. So there is no. There is a few years ago, it was very difficult to even begin to compete with them. But now it's changing because there's a lot of really great small independent news websites that are really picking up the slack because up to, I'd say, a few years ago, the strategy in dealing with these large-scale protests that were breaking out in Moscow and other places for the state media was just to ignore them, to blacklist them from their coverage, to pretend that they're not happening. Which is what happened with a similar protest 2 years ago, and I was there, and it was quite surreal. So I was in the middle of what was basically a police lockdown of the entire downtown, with the police helicopters hovering overhead, and thousands of riot police, again greatly outnumbering the protesters. And then when I checked the websites of the biggest news homepages of the biggest news websites in the country, there was not a peep about these protests going on. And with that in the background, a few independent websites, including Medusa, where I work now, they did wall-to-wall coverage of this protest. And at some point, Medusa, for example, it outdid the biggest news websites in the country, the biggest news agencies, like TASS, that big Soviet news agency, which is really dominating the news landscape. It had more page views than these big websites. So they're now, you know, trying quite desperately to cope with that, and they're passing new laws specifically designed to hamper the progress of these small independent websites like ours, with laws that prohibit, well, everything from you know, you can be there's kind of a two strikes and you're out law that you can get a strike for you know, allowing obscenities on air. So even if you link to a YouTube video where somebody says an F word in a 40 minute video, you can get a strike, and after two strikes you lose a license. So new laws like this are being passed almost every few months. And you're all but excluded from the ad market. You cannot raise money. You cannot really cover certain sensitive political topics. But you know, things are. I'd say things are getting better. And there's, you know, a whole new generation of young, eager reporters who are not afraid to face these challenges. So I'd say I'm fairly optimistic.
And, you know, the thing that's so interesting, Alexei, as you know, the coverage of that Russia gets here in the United States is fairly simplistic. And a lot of people have a very limited understanding of the relationship between the state and civil society. There's this idea, especially in many media outlets, that Vladimir Putin runs everything. So how would you explain the relationship between the state and civil society?
Well, yeah, of course, that's, that would be very simplistic thing to say that Vladimir Putin controls everything, because as much as he wants to, he really doesn't. So let me give you an example that kind of illustrates the relationship between the society and different layers of authority in Russia. Something that happened to our own reporter a couple of months ago. So he was working on a big investigative piece that exposed the corrupt relationship between Russian secret services and the funeral business, which is a huge monopoly. And of course, if you have access to the kind of authority that would allow you to do that, you want to get that under control and turn it into a source of revenue. So he was working on a big investigative piece that came out in July, and all of a sudden, one day he was arrested in the street by the drug police, and they planted drugs on him, and he was looking at 20 years for drug smuggling. Of course, he didn't do that, and he was framed. But what was something that really surprised everyone is that it was happening in the background of the biggest media event of the year, the St. Petersburg Economic Forum. And instead of asking ministers of economy and big business people and Vladimir Putin about Russia's investment prospects, all the reporters in the hundreds of foreign reporters were really, really haranguing the Russian officials. What's happening to this guy? Why is he being arrested? And I was told that Putin was in Kansas with rage, because they really spoiled this biggest event of the year for him. And if he could, he would have prevented it, of course. But he doesn't really control he doesn't know the every single thing that's happening on every single level. And in the middle of these layered cake of secret services and political circles, the middle layers are just really out there, they're just looking for profit for themselves, not taking into account any of the big political events. They're not giving it any thought. They were just trying to prevent an investigative piece that exposed them from coming out. Nobody actually gave it a single thought about the consequences of trying to frame an investigative reporter. And of course, 5 days later, the whole case he just disintegrated, and they had to let him go. But it's just one example of how things work in Russia, and I could give you a few others. For example, everyone's focused on Moscow because Russia is very Moscow-centric, because that's where all the national media offices are and all the foreign media bureaus. But protests have actually been happening for a few months, and I'd say a couple of years, over local causes all over Russia. There was a big protest this spring against a church. They wanted to put a big church in a park in Yekaterinburg, which is the capital of the Urals in eastern Russia. And there were ongoing protests for weeks in downtown, and they actually had to drop the project because there was only so much you can achieve with violence until it becomes just really unmanageable, until people get to grow too angry. And for example, in this case, the authorities had to step back with the project. And you can't really solve everything with throwing as many riot police as you can at this protest, because they tend to escalate. And at the same time, you cannot give in too much, so as not to create an impression with these protesters that you can pressure the authorities into doing something or not doing something. So it's a very thin ice. And of course, Putin and people in his circles, they have to navigate these very complex layers of relationship between the society and the authorities. So it's a lot more complicated than that, than just Putin sitting at the top of a pyramid and controlling everything, and he's omnipotent and he's omniscient. No, it's not like that.
Hmm. Alexei Kovalev is a reporter, head of investigations at Medusa. It's an independent Russian news outlet, and he has been writing about the protests for The Guardian. And today we're talking with him about the media landscape in Russia and also the protests that have been happening since July 14th, when the Moscow Election Commission rejected 17 opposition candidates from running for seats on the municipal council. So let's dive in and talk about this. Alexei, these elections are scheduled to take place on September 8th, and tens of thousands of people have protested the government's decision to bar candidates from taking part. First off, tell us about these elections. How important are they, and do they usually get this much attention?
No, they're not important at all, because this is all about the elections in the, basically, it's Moscow City Council. And it's one of the most it's actually one of the most powerless local assemblies in Russia, and it doesn't really decide anything. Up until now, it's been a rubber stamp for the city hall to rubber stamp the decisions made upstairs in this, in the mayor's office. And last year, at the last elections in 2014, the turnout was about 20%. So that's about as many people cared about these local council elections. But again, this is where, you know, Russian politics gets complicated. And they could have just let these opposition candidates run, and they aren't really that popular. They could have let them run and lose. They could have let them run and with a token seat in this really insignificant local assembly. And then a few years later, they could unseat them or co-opt them or charge them with some economic crime and jail them. And nobody would really take notice except for a few hundred of their followers. But no, the Kremlin, and I'm fairly sure that it was, the decision was made in the Kremlin that no, you cannot allow the opposition to win even a token symbolic seat in this assembly. So they barred them from running under the most ridiculous pretenses. Like, they found really insignificant violations of the electoral code, which is really Byzantine and complicated, and specifically designed to keep people from running, because you have to invest a lot of time and a lot of resources to run for this really insignificant local council seat. But these few candidates from the opposition, and it's not like there's a lot of different people, a lot of different political opinions, and not all of them are there isn't a single opposition party or anything like that. Just a few people who wanted to run for the local elections and start small. But no, they barred all of them. For example, there were people whose campaigns were infiltrated by agents of the government who put fraudulent signatures on their petitions list. So electoral law in Russia works like this. So if you're a non-partisan candidate, you have to gather like 5,000 signatures of your supporters in order to be eligible to run. So government agents injected these agents into these campaigns who signed fake signatures into their petitions, or the electoral commissions dismissed hundreds of these signatures, telling them that these signatures are fake. But then real people who put the signatures on these petitions came forward and said, no, we are real people and we actually signed those petitions. But now they dismiss these people. And that was in early July, and that's where things got really, really intense, because you can't just tell people you don't exist and hope to get away with it. And people just started coming out to protest. But it's really about it's not about the presidency or getting a seat in the parliament. It's really about not much of anything.
So if you say this would have not been a big deal to let them run because they probably would have lost anyway, what explains this decision?
Because it's a single seat for the opposition would mean that they. This would be a huge symbolic win for the opposition, regardless of whether they would have any actual powers. This would be a symbolic win and a huge symbolic loss for the Kremlin, because that's been their propaganda line for the last few years. That, you know, you're aiming too high. You're aiming for the Kremlin. Why don't you start small and start it with your local council? So they did actually win some seats at the local council a few years ago, and now they're going for the local legislative assembly. And even with a single seat, totally outnumbered by pro-government candidates, they could at least, demand to see how the money is being spent in Moscow, or, with the powers that they would have as local council members, they could expose the corruption that's going on in the city hall. So it's really about the symbolism of these small incremental wins for the opposition. And nobody in the Kremlin wants that. So nobody, maybe some people do want that, and maybe there are some sane voices in the Kremlin, probably advising, Putin's advisors, telling them to maybe we should really let this thing slide, and maybe they would calm things down. But no, the Kremlin's ideologues, they have these, they call this opposition, they call this non-systemic opposition, like you are not integrated into the system. So you don't have any supporters, or you don't have a platform. But now that argument would be invalid because these people are actually elected officials. So you cannot just dismiss them like that. Like you're nobody.
So you have opposition figures like Ilya Yashin, who was arrested for organizing an unauthorized protest, is now calling to cancel the elections. And then you have opposition leader Alexei Navalny, who was released today after spending a month in jail for calling a quote, unsanctioned protest. How do these opposition leaders plan to respond? What are their plans from here on out? Do you know?
So now they have, now that they've don't have any hope at all left to have their candidates, have their followers run in these elections, they're calling for what they call a campaign of smart voting. So the goal of this is to vote for any candidate that is not supported by the Kremlin. So we have a few kind of complacent. So we have the non-systemic opposition that's barred from any political process altogether. There is a middle ground, the integrated opposition. So it kind of plays ball most of the time, and it's rubber stamps the Kremlin and the city hall initiatives. But the point of this is to of this strategy to prop up the nominal opposition to the Kremlin is to dilute the absolute majorities of pro-Kremlin candidates and pro-Kremlin representatives in these legislatures, and at the same time emboldening the opposition to maybe be more proactive in resisting the Kremlin. So we'll see how it goes. On September 8th, we'll see how successful that strategy is. But so far, the state is responding with the full force of measures, both legal and illegal, in its disposal. And what they're trying to do with the with Alexei Navalny and Ilya Yashin, who is actually an elected official in his local district, and he's quite popular. So you cannot tell his supporters that he's a nobody. What they're trying to do is to decapitate the protest movement, but because it's so amorphous, the plan didn't work. So they were planning to kind of preemptively arrest all these people, all the opposition leaders, and not jailing them. So they aren't technically serving a prison term. So they are giving them so they are convicting them for several consecutive administrative arrests. So, for example, normally you would be arrested for violations of, for example, of like calling to an unsanctioned protest. And every time, for example, in Moscow, you cannot just go and rally whatever you want. You have to apply for a permit. But what's happening now is that, for example, this week, they were planning this big rally. And they said, so we need this big square. Or we need this street in Moscow where we would have enough space to accommodate 50,000 people. And their application was rejected because, hey, all of a sudden there's a festival going on. On the square. Yeah, so they were, of course, they have nothing. They had thousands of their supporters sign up for this rally.
And let me, Alexei, just quickly, yes, before we let you go, the New York Times cited a Facebook post from Alesky Makokrin, a political analyst in Russia, and he said that people across Russia are agitated by prices, pensions, social security, and environmental protection, all issues that protesters have not yet addressed. And he said if they do address these and the opposition integrates these items into their agendas, the situation could really sustain itself and become serious. What are your thoughts on that? What's next? And do you think those issues will be integrated?
You really can't protest against everything at the same time. So you can't protest against all that's wrong in the country at any given moment. So I'd say being more focused, you know, based on past experience, being more focused in your protest helps more. But I wouldn't dismiss it as a strategy because, you know, people... everywhere in Russia, they look up to Moscow because Moscow sets the trends. So if people in Moscow support some local issues that are going on in Russia, like environmental issues, like illegal garbage dumping in the north, or, you know, forest fires in Siberia, that could probably help them win a broader base.
Well, Alexei, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for your reporting, and we'd love to have you back.
Thank you.
Thank you. Alexei Kovalev, he is head of investigations at Medusa, an independent Russian news outlet. He's been writing about the protest for The Guardian. He joined us from Moscow, and you can find his pieces at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we will get the latest on Planned Parenthood's decision to leave Title 10. That is the Federal Family Planning Program. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio. A review of the week's news is coming up next hour on 1A at 11 o'clock in 1/2 hour here on 91.7 KALW.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can listen to past shows and sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. You can also send us ideas or feedback at yourcall@kalw.org. Planned Parenthood has decided to leave Title 10. That is the federal family planning program that provides health services to 1.5 million low-income people every year, rather than comply with a Trump administration rule that forbids abortion referrals. $60 million in annual funds have allowed Planned Parenthood to provide services like birth control and pregnancy tests. Rewire.news reports that the impact will be felt across the country. In Utah, Planned Parenthood is the only Title 10 grantee. Alexis McGill Johnson, who is Planned Parenthood's acting president, said that wait times for appointments will skyrocket and people will delay or even go without care. Women will have to drive hundreds of miles to find a provider who can help them with things like birth control. Overall, the $286 million federal family planning program serves 4 million people with low incomes across the country. Joining us to talk about this and media coverage is Jody Jacobson, president and editor-in-chief of Rewire.news, an online publication focused on health, rights, and justice. Hi, Jody. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you, as always, for having me.
Well, thank you, as always, for joining us. We're also joined by Khushbu Shah. Khushbu is an independent journalist who has reported for a number of publications, including The Washington Post and The Guardian. She recently wrote an in-depth series of stories for The Guardian called Abortion in the Deep South. Hi, Khushbu. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. So, Jody, let's start off with you. Before we talk about media coverage, can you give us a brief overview of Title 10 and talk about why it is so important to low-income women and poor women across the country?
Yeah, so Title 10 is a program that's roughly 50 years old and has been enforced for all of those years, providing federal funding to clinics throughout the country to provide basic reproductive health services, a form of health care that is a form of health care. I just want to repeat that. It's a form of health care. And basically, you've got everything from STD and HIV testing to treatment to contraceptive delivery, a wide range of different kinds of services and health care options that people need, not just women, but people need.
Right.
Men use these services, transgender folks use these services. So it's really primary health care that's been provided through Title X funding. It also ensures, for example, that low-income people or people who are not insured are able to access those services free or at a reduced rate. So you're really doing... It's a public health benefit of really unestimable proportions or inestimable proportions. The CDC has before said that the development of modern contraception is one of the greatest public health advances of the 20th century. Well, Title X is one of the greatest public health interventions of the last century and of this century, and is increasingly important but now endangered.
So Planned Parenthood is going to forego $60 million in federal funding. And like I said, your reporters put out stories about how in Utah, Planned Parenthood is the only Title X grantee. What about other family planning clinics that serve these women? How are they responding to this new rule?
You mean other than
Planned Parenthood, right? Like independent family planning providers and clinics.
So the new rules are basically targeted at Planned Parenthood. There are relatively few other clinics that are set up. There may be some, but there are relatively few others that are set up in the same way, because lots of them are part of, you know, sort of public health clinics that are part of the government in some way or the other, and never were able to provide or refer for abortion. And the thing about Planned Parenthood is severalfold. One, Planned Parenthood does provide and or refer for abortion. So if someone comes in and needs an abortion, they will either counsel and offer that person an abortion care or refer that person somewhere for abortion care. They might also follow up with other services like contraception, et cetera, whereas federally qualified health centers that might be getting Title X funds or other health centers that might be getting Title X funds are not doing that abortion care and not necessarily referring. So it wouldn't necessarily affect them. The second thing is that obviously Planned Parenthood has had a target on its back for a long time, in part because it's not only a provider of care and abortion care included, but it's also a mobilizer and an advocate for reproductive health care and abortion care. And so by targeting Planned Parenthood, you're not only targeting a service, you're targeting a powerful political force. Most people around the country know what Planned Parenthood is. Millions of women have used Planned Parenthood. Millions of people have used Planned Parenthood and know Planned Parenthood to be a very, the reliable provider of services they need, and therefore are out there to protect Planned Parenthood and vote on behalf of Planned Parenthood, which is something the fundamentalist right does not like.
Mm-hmm. Khushbu, you recently wrote a series of in-depth stories for The Guardian called Abortion in the Deep South. And we'll talk about your pieces that show how incredibly difficult it is today for women, men, trans people to get access to this kind of care. Without Title IX money, what now? I mean, how do you think these women, a lot of the women that you met in your reporting, will be affected?
That's a really good question. There were already about 90% of the people we spoke to, and I think I spoke to about three dozen women along that road trip that I took. You know, they first of all, they don't let loved ones know that they're going to have an abortion or they're contemplating getting an abortion. And so what happens is that these people have to sort of scrounge up money in certain circumstances, whether it's taking on a second or third job, or, you know, asking for loans, and a lot of their family members and loved ones don't necessarily support them already. And there's an instance, I think, in one of the pieces out of Louisiana where a woman was still $30 short because nobody in her family supported her abortion, getting an abortion, which was happening in 3 days after we spoke to her. And in the end, she had to work at an illegal gambling location in her small town in eastern Texas to scrounge up, I think it was $30. There are some instances also, though, that in the South where there are abortion funds, independent abortion funds available, and I think in each state they're quite a few, and they might even outnumber some of the clinics and organizations that have provided abortions. And so they do have that option still, but because they're so strapped and they're in such high demand, even that woman, the woman that was still lacking funds for her abortion just 3 days out, she didn't qualify, for example, for that abortion fund from an independent organization because she was told that there are too many people ahead of you that actually are in even more dire need than you are.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's a great question.
What are your thoughts on this, Jody? I mean, we've had you on the show for years now talking about just how difficult it is for people to get access. What other options will they have once this funding goes away?
Well, you know, Rose, and Khushbu, I'm sure, knows that that this, again, has been sort of like, you know, a thinning line, a thinning piece of string, or I'm not getting the right analogy here, but that over time, a variety of different steps have been taken to limit access to abortion care, whether they are so-called trap laws or targeted regulations against abortion providers that have no medical requirement or no medical reason to exist, but were just meant to eliminate abortion providers, or, you know, clinic regulations that make no sense, or things like, you know, requiring doctors to get admitting privileges at hospitals, the boards of which are full of anti-choicers. There's so many ways in which abortion care has been diminished in this country, clinic-based care. And so, you know, I think increasingly people are going to be traveling, as they already are, from one state to the other when they can get the money. And when they can't get the money, they won't be traveling. Some will resort to self-inducing abortion in dangerous ways. Others are already trying to find access to medication abortion, whether online or through, you know, less trackable channels. And it should be said that there, you know, medication abortion is and can be very, very safe. It should be widely publicly available. But the problem is that in many places it is also made illegal under different kinds of rules that either say you can't self-induce an abortion or you can't buy this medication. And so there really is kind of, you know, a narrowing set of options for people in need of abortion care in this country. And I don't see it. It's a specific particular service, but I don't necessarily see it as very different from the bigger picture, which is that we have an increasingly fascist government, which has been that way for a long time before Trump. It's not just Trump, but they don't care about public health. I mean, they don't care about things as simple as vaccinations or cervical cancer or ensuring people get access to contraception or ensuring people get access to primary health care of any kind. They don't care. And so, you know, this is another target that I think has a different aspect to it, not just the I don't care about public health and people will die kind of aspect, but also limiting access to contraception means that, in their minds, more people will have babies and therefore demographic trends in the country will be reversed. That's the thinking. So I think there's, you know, another element to it other than just we don't care about public health or that people die or they can't afford health care, which I think is all true, but rather there's that demographic aspect to it.
Jody Jacobson is president and editor-in-chief of Rewire.news, an online publication focusing on health, rights, and justice. We're also joined by Khushboo Shah, an independent journalist who reports for a number of outlets. And I hope you can take some time, maybe over the weekend, to read the series of stories she wrote for The Guardian called Abortion in the Deep South. And for this piece, she took a road trip to Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana, where there are very strict laws against abortion. And she spoke to 36 women. You know, what really struck me about your pieces, Khushboo, and I think it's important to talk about this, we talk a lot about how hard it is to get access, which of course is so incredibly important. We don't talk as much about what people have to go through simply for walking from their car to the clinic, how they get screamed at, how there are posters, you know, people are knocking on their windows. And you really did an amazing job of writing about that. So can you tell us what really struck you when you were outside of those clinics?
Well, so I'll give you a little personal insight. As well, when I did this, I was actually 7.5 months pregnant. It was my last on-the-road assignment. And actually, at one of the clinics, they came up to my car as I was parking to see somebody, one of the doctors, and, you know, tried to offer me a gift to change my mind and go to a crisis pregnancy center, which is an anti-abortion center slash, some of them call themselves medical clinics, depending on if they have an ultrasound there and a registered nurse. So it happened to me, too, which I didn't realize, you know, how... And they had come up on private property, which was really invasive, right? And so that's when I told them I was a journalist. But, you know, and I just thought, okay, well, it can't be that difficult, right? Just you have to ignore them. But they are, it is just a different level of just invasiveness. For example, the one clinic in Mississippi, the only clinic, actually, in the state, some of the anti-abortion protesters, what they would use were similar vests to the clinic escort, and when people would ask them, well, okay, well, where do I park, what do I do, they would instead try to tell them, steer them towards the crisis pregnancy centers, or try to give them some information about adoption instead, and would ignore the crisis, or they would follow them into the clinic as far as they could go, and it was just, you know, and it's really traumatizing for people who are already and, you know, already having a hard time was, you know, deciding, or people haven't decided even if they're going to have a procedure done. And a few of them said, you know, it's very traumatic having to, you know, think about what they want to do, the decisions they'd like to make, you know, think about, as you already mentioned, you know, the myriad of, you know, cost, travel, logistics, you know, can make this happen? What are my other options in the future? And on top of that, you have people, you know, sort of just following you with speakerphones, you know, telling you that you're doing horrible things, you know, to your unborn child, you know, and at that point, some of them were not, you know, they're at 6 weeks and they don't know what's going on. So it was just really interesting because at every single stop that I made along the way, there was some sort of interaction with anti-abortion protesters. And it was just, you know, you just don't realize how constant it is and how, and it's in people's faces, you know, as they're trying to make clearly, you know, a difficult decision or, you know, a very important decision.
Wow. And Jody, you know, Khushboo in her piece reports that in Georgia, there are more than 90 of these, quote, crisis pregnancy centers. They outnumber abortion providers nearly 3-1, where the, you know, the state just passed one of the toughest laws in the country. It would outlaw abortion after 6 weeks. And Jody, you monitor the media so closely. What are your thoughts on how the media report on these crisis pregnancy centers? Because recently, I heard NPR mention these crisis pregnancy centers, but they didn't tell listeners what they are. So what are your thoughts on how the media should talk about these centers?
Well, I think generally speaking, the media, brought, you know, writ large, and obviously there are exceptions, does a horrible job, because it so often media outlets, NPR is one of the worst, try this kind of, you know, approaching it from a bland perspective as though there were no question about, you know, whether and how or when certain kinds of centers or certain kinds of services are actually doing the work that they are meant to do. If you had a series of medical dental clinics, let's say, out there that were offering, you know, unlicensed and erroneous dental care, lying to people about dental care, would it be reported the same way? I don't think so. And so there's this kind of, I think, pejorative way in or you know, way that is very dangerous, because it's a service that mostly women and mostly transgender persons need, and it's treated as though we don't have to report on it scientifically, we don't have to report on it critically, we don't have to be you know, telling the truth about these things. I think it's really the treatment of these centers is very bland in a very dangerous way. It's untruthful. It's a lie. And they are there literally to lie to people, to tell women they are not that far along in their pregnancy when they're further along, or to tell women that, or people who seek abortion, that if they get an abortion, they will, you know, inevitably have mental illness, or they will have breast cancer. Just flat out lies. So I think media that does not report these things accurately is responsible for the public health consequences that we see coming out. I mean, right now we know in Texas, for example, that there are extraordinarily high rates of cervical cancer being found. Why is that? Well, and I would suggest it has to do with the fact that Texas, for a very long time, has been slashing reproductive health services, and people can't get access to, first of all, the pap smears that might tell them they have early cervical dysplasia, which could then be treated with, you know, things that could prevent cervical cancer.
And Jody, in terms of these so-called crisis pregnancy centers, can you give us a sense, how fast are they growing? Who's funding them? Who's behind this? I mean, as Kushbu reports, in some of these centers, there's just one medical professional, like a nurse. But the majority of the people in these centers are not medical professionals.
Yeah. Well, and if you can call someone a medical professional, that actually lies. I mean, we did a story a while ago, this is a few years ago now, where we found out that in California, you know, California, Democratic state, right, loophole in the law in California was allowing public funds to be used by anti-choicers to quote-unquote teach continuing education to nurses, providing lies about medication abortion. And that loophole got closed, but nonetheless, you know, these things are out there. And so in terms of crisis pregnancy centers, states are now using taxpayer funding to fund those centers in many states. And they are actually transferring funds from actual public health work into those centers. So I find it's beyond Orwellian. It is really, truly actually undermining people's health and lying to them to do so. And it's very nefarious. And to me, it's part of a fascist state. And we have to be really cognizant of what's going on and angry about it, because why should your and my and other people's tax dollars be going to lie to people that need care? And remember, as Kushbu has been reporting, remember, a lot of these people are living in rural areas, they're lower income, they have to struggle to get somewhere in the first place, only to be lied to. It's really, really unconscionable.
Kush, but before we let you go, just quickly, we're almost out of time. Another piece you wrote about is about the powerhouse, which gives women a place of sanctuary as they wait for their procedure at Montgomery, Alabama's only abortion clinic next door. And as you report, in Alabama, the legislature passed a bill to ban most abortions after 6 weeks, even in the cases of rape and incest. So can you quickly tell us about this safe house, one that you know of? It's one of the only in the country.
Right, and I think there have been a lot of stories, to be fair, about the safe house. What I found particularly interesting about the powerhouse was that, and what I focused on in my piece, was the sort of sanctuary that it provided for the loved ones that were accompanying people to the procedures, right, which happened, and as the protesters know, the anti-abortion protesters, and the mobile crisis center that's parked right outside across the street from the abortion clinic every Friday morning. And so what they do is that they open the doors at the powerhouse from 5 a.m. and they actually have a police car parked out front to keep the protesters from entering their private property. And what they do is they just have a safe space for cousins, sisters, husbands, aunts, et cetera, boyfriends, girlfriends, to wait with people while they go get their abortion and the procedure done. You know, a lot of times it was just a really interesting day because what ended up happening that day was there were women and husbands and anybody else, friends, sitting around on the porch, and you can hear the protesters, you know, yelling at people, calling them the devil, and telling them that, you know, they're going to hell, and they're sitting around, you know, drink their coffees, waiting, you know, I think some of them waited, 10 hours, longest, the last procedure was done at 3 p.m. And, you know, they're talking about how difficult it was for them to show up here, as Jody mentioned, you know, some of them had driven from out of state, some of them had spent the night with powerhouse SMG because they can't afford hotel rooms. Some of them didn't actually believe in some of the procedures that their loved one was getting, but they said, you know what, it's their decision. Let me, you know, let me show up and support them. You know, one mom had said, you know, this is, my daughter doesn't know this, but I had a procedure, you know, before I had her 30 years ago. And so, you know, I just wanted her to have support because no one came with me when I went. And so it's just really interesting because it was the only place I saw where there was actually some space away from the protesters, right, and away from the clinic. You don't have to sit in a sterile office. You know, you don't have to, you know, be confronted with protesters, you know, you wait in your car for 8 hours, or maybe you end up, you know, going to the Waffle House across the street, or the Wendy's, and, you know, there's actually a place where you can take a nap, or, you know, you can take a...
And Kushbu, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're out of time. And I just want to apologize for the bad quality of Kushbu's line. She is about to have a baby any day now, so she had to do the interview by cell phone, and we just didn't know that the line was going to be so bad, so I'm really sorry about that. Kushbu Shah is an independent journalist, and I hope you can read her excellent series of stories that she wrote for The Guardian called Abortion in the Deep South. Thank you so much, Kushbu. Jody Jacobson is president and editor-in-chief of Rewire.News, an excellent online publication focusing on health, rights, and justice. As always, Jody, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. Thank you. Thank you, Kushbu.
And thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls Media Roundtable.